Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to our latest FA Cup round on the way to Wembley. We've reached the semi-finals in our Shocks Come Giant Killers series. So many we could have picked from. We ummed and ahed, well, you know, and Bill has the final say on this, because this is Bill's brainchild. You know, we did threaten Liverpool 3, Crystal Palace 4. Sharp intake of breath at my end. And maybe we'll do that one next year for my therapy session. But on the, I think we need to call this the Paul McParland program in terms of therapy, because for Dave Bowler there is a massive amount of therapy to be found in this one. It's 1982. It's Highbury. It's West Bromwich Albion, first division West Bromwich Albion against second division Queen's Park Rangers, and you know, a lovely sunny day. The same venue that West Brom had lost out in 4 years earlier against Ipswich Town in a blood-splattered classic semi-final, with that amazing kit as well of West Brom's. That has to be said, the yellow and green stripes is just an absolute peach of a kit. The Umbro with the diamonds down the sleeves and all of that. That for that kit alone, that side needed to reach the FA Cup final. But you know, we have to forgive Ipswich a little bit as well, because they had a bit of iconography there too. But this is 1982, the chance for West Brom to absolve the traumas of 4 years earlier. It's in the palm of their hand, a place at Wembley. They've been forsaken in the League Cup, losing out to Spurs in the semi-finals of that competition. Surely they can't get this one wrong, Dave.
Oh, you've right and say. Of course we can get this wrong.
But of course, before we get into it, we need to bring in the doyen of our FA Cup run, Bill Hearn. Welcome back, Bill.
Hiya, Stephen. Good to be back.
It's going to be a good one. We're straight into it. Dave, you were there. Give us a bit of a taste of the build-up to the game and what your feelings were on the day going into the match.
It's funny, because I was there 4 years earlier at Highbury for the 78 one, and we were on North Bank that year. This year, we got the clock end at Highbury. So I suppose, you know, football fans being the superstitious types that we are, I suppose we were quite pleased that we were at the other end, because we thought, that'll break the hoodoo. I mean, Highbury was never a very good ground for Albion. Cup matches, league matches, nothing. It wasn't a ground where we did particularly well. It was a weird season. I mean, this is the season of the Brian Robson departure at the start of the season. Ron Atkinson went in the summer, took Brian Robson and Remy Moses with him. So it was a really tough season for Albion in the league. Only stayed up pretty much in the last week with a game against Leeds United at the Hawthorns, where the police horses played a major part at the finish. It was an absolute riot. But in the cups, we had a great year. We got to the semi-finals of the League Cup, where we lost 1-0 over two legs to Top. And then you get to the FA Cup semi-final. And it's when the draw comes out, this is the one you want. You want QPR, obviously, you know, second division team. And you're thinking, right, okay, finally we're going to, you know, get somewhere. We're going to get back to Wembley and we're going to make something of the season. So as all football fans are, you inevitably think you're going to lose in these big games, because that's just our nature, isn't it? You know, but at the same time, going down to London, I think, you know, we felt, right, okay, we're not playing particularly well. Cyril Regis was having a great season. He scored 20-odd goals and, you know, he'd scored a couple of crackers in the cup and all of that, and you just felt, okay, it might be close, but I think we'll get through and we'll be at Wembley, and thank God for that. And you know, we can hopefully then start to rebuild the club a little bit after the Brian Robson thing, but as we'll see, things didn't quite go that way.
Bill, West Brom as part of this, they've got so much going for them, even though it's an inconsistent league season. Yes, they've lost, you know, Ron Atkinson. Yes, you know, Brian Robson's moved along, Remy Moses as well. But this is, you know, Cyril Regis is in there. This is a player who I think would have gone to the World Cup had he not picked that injury up. All credit to Peter Withen and all that. If Tony Morley isn't making that England World Cup squad fully fit, you know, I think fully fit Cyril Regis is barring Peter Withen's root into that squad as well. Certainly, you know, if I'm picking the squad, that would be the case. West Brom at this point in time, Bill, you know, the two cup domestic cup semi-finals that season. It's a hit and miss kind of season, but we are talking fine margins here between, you know, what could have been and what was.
At the time of the semi-final, they weren't doing too badly. They weren't really embroiled in the relegation struggle. That came after the semi-final. They managed to lose 9 out of the next 10 games. And as Dave said, it got to the penultimate game before they secured their safety. He didn't mention that a couple of days later, they probably let Stoke City stay up, because when they beat Leeds, that relegated Leeds effectively, because Stoke beat West Brom 2 days later and leapt over Leeds. So certainly the defeat had a very, very bad impact on West Brom's season. I take Dave's point about supporters thinking we might lose this one, even though on paper we should win it. And today I've been kind of swinging whether, you know, was it really a giant killing? Because you look at the Queen's Park Rangers side, they've got 4 England internationals, Fenwick, Gillard, Curry, Clive Allen. But then I look at West Brom, and they've got a great side as well. You know, they've got, as you say, they've got Cyril Regis, they've got Derek Statham, they've got John Wyle. And in the 120th anniversary for West Brom, they voted for their top 16 players of all time. And 3 of that West Bromwich team got into their all-time best 16. So you've got a quarter of your team who are arguably your best players ever. So logically, West Brom should win. Or QPR and no mugs at all. Very, very strong team. They've got players like Bob Hazel, Glenn Roeder, Simon Stainrod, who I always rated really, really highly. But then again, you've got Ali Robertson, Brendan Batson in the West Brom side. Having said that, how did it turn out to be such a lousy game with players like that? Was it nerves?
I don't know what it was, but it was a game where absolutely nothing happened, really. I mean, you know, I can remember the semi-final from 4 years ago. It was a great, you know, it was a really good game and plenty happened. Okay, we lost. But I can remember lots of that like it was yesterday. I cannot remember a thing, really, about this one. It was just a total non-event, really, as a game. I mean, watched some of the highlights this morning in preparation for this. And firstly, I couldn't remember any of them. And but secondly, there were no highlights, to be perfectly honest. I mean, you know, They managed to put about 10 minutes together, I think it was.
Even the goal was scrappy, wasn't it?
It was an absolutely abysmal goal, which I'm sure we'll come on to later on. But it was just one of those games. I mean, you know, a lot of semi-finals are like that, aren't they? You know, there's so much at stake. And I think, as you say, Bill, there was, you know, it's a big Albion team. But I think with 2 or 3 of them, you know, you look at John Wall and Ali Robertson, who'd never won anything, never been to Wembley even with Albion. And this was coming. This must have been their last chance, you know. I think that played a part with the sort of the tension of the game. And I just think it was, the stakes were so high that just never got going at all. And QPR played really, really well. You know, Bob Hazel had a terrific game. But I mean, Bob Hazel played years in the first division, didn't he, for Wolves? And he played Cyril really well that day. And Albion's problem that season was if you got rid of Cyril, there was nobody else liable to do much. And that was how it turned out on the day.
Yeah, I mean, certainly what highlights they were, Bob Hazel featured in most of them, didn't he? He
was all over them.
He certainly did a good job on Cyril.
That was a problem, really. There was nothing going for Albion at all. And, you know, I spoke to John Wall years later and you know, he said it was a complete non-event, and he remembered, because the goal comes quite late in the game, and he remembers after about an hour, him and Ali Robertson were walking up the pitch as Albion were taking the goal kick, and they were talking to one another. Where's the replay? The replay at Villa Park, given that we've had to come down to London, and then of course there was no replay.
Are you just running down the team there? You know, it's the QPR side: Peter Hooker, Claxon, Hooker, Fenwick, Gillard, Waddock, Hazel, Roeder, Curry, Flanagan, Allen. Stainrod, Micklewhite with Burke on the bench. Obviously, Terry Venables as the manager. As mentioned, 4 England internationals, 2 England internationals to be, 2 who had you know, played for and seen the last of their England days. And you know, that is a fantastic side. You know, in Gary Waddock, you know, an underrated midfielder. He went to the World Cup with Ireland in 1990 as well. Don't think he played a playing part at all, but you know he played a pivotal role in getting there. You know, aside again, you know, of its era in that second division, packed with plenty of talent. You know, we only have to look 2 years previously to the quality of the West Ham side that made the 82 final. So the 1980 final for you know the players that they had at their disposal. You know, this is still you know it's a very different era in players, you know, remaining with sides and being recruited by sides that have dropped out of the first division into the second and have that eye on a return to the top flight. Again, you know, an era that's not, you know, based in squad ethics. It's, you know, you start in 11 and if you drop out of that side, you've done so because A, your form has dropped through the floor or you've got injured. You know, there'd be no other way out of a side. For so many of these players. I mean, Dave, this QPR side, you know, it does have a lot going for it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, Tony Curry, who was like Tony Curry right through the 70s, and he continued to be, you know, at that stage, you know, what would he be, 32, 33 probably. And that so many teams of that era would have, particularly in the second division that were doing well, they would have a player like him that had dropped down a division, but was controlling matches from midfield just because he knew exactly what he was doing. I mean, he wasn't moving, he wasn't running around, he wasn't, you know, he was standing pretty much within the centre circle, but he was dictating games from there because he knew the game, he could pass the ball so well and all of that sort of stuff. He might drop a bit deeper and help out the centre halves and that kind of thing. And as you say, players that had played in the top division, Bob Hazel, good goal scorer in Clive Allen, Terry Fenwick, Glenn Roeder, you know, both good players in defence who had long, long careers. Plenty of quality there. So, I mean, there was no way we were thinking, oh, this is a walkover, this is going to be a doddle. But of course, you know, first division versus second division, you know, you've got to feel that you're the favourites. But on the day, they were slightly less inhibited than Albion were. I mean, you know, from their perspective, they didn't have to do anything. You know, they weren't the ones that were expected to press the game. They weren't the ones expected to win. They could just play their normal game. They could let Albion try and break them down, and they could hit on the break if necessary. And again, looking at the highlights, not that either goalkeeper makes any saves, to be perfectly honest, but the chances that come to QPR, they're the ones that have one or two opportunities before Clive Allen finally scores. And it was just, I mean, they were well marshalled, and Albion were a side that had gone past the peak by this point. I mean, there are only four players in that team from the team that played in 78. Now, the 78 team was a genuinely top-class first division team and, you know, the last proper Albion team in that sense. But there's only four of them left by then. Two of them, John Ward and Ali Robertson, are coming towards the end. And then you got Derek Statham and Cyril Regis. And the rest of the players that have come in, I don't think any of them have improved on what there was in that 78 team. I think in every position, good players, you know, first division players, but none of them as good as that team that there was in 78. And, you know, when that happens, you're not going to get such good results, are you?
I think, to be fair with Queen's Park Rangers, they just missed out on promotion that season. And who knows, the cup run might have cost them those few points. But they walked away with the second division the following season. And the season after that, they were fifth. So, you know, they were a very, very good side. And on the way up as well, of course, with Terry Venables at the helm too. So they had a lot going for them.
That West Brom side, you know, we'll rattle down the 12 there as well. Grew, Batson, Statham, Zondervan, Wiley, Robertson, Bennett, King, Regis, Cross, McKenzie, Owen on the bench. You know, in his commentary preamble, John Motson says that now Owen is dropped in favour of McKenzie. This is Steve McKenzie, who scored the absolute screamer in the 81 FA Cup final replay for Manchester City 11 months earlier. Bill, this West Brom side, as Dave said, yeah, there's some coming towards an end, but you know these are still seasoned first division campaigners, and you know this opportunity to reach an FA Cup final. And it's the potential springboard that it could, it doesn't always work that way, but you know, the potential springboard for a few years still to come, and to put the club back in the spotlight as well. in terms of maybe attracting, fresh talent in the summer?
Yeah, I think as Dave said, they've got some very, very good players, but they're not great players. And I think that's where they just fell a little bit short. I mean, players like Steve McKenzie, very, very good player, but he's no Laurie Cunningham, is he? And likewise, Andy King, a great, great player, but not international quality. I think West Bromwich have probably missed the boat, haven't they? John Wyle, Ali Robertson, as you said, Dave, are probably, if not past their best, certainly, getting towards the end of their careers. And they struggled in the league as well. And they didn't get any better the following season. So I think they were a team on a downward sort of slope. And, perhaps time caught up with them in the semi-final. So it was nerves. I don't know. I mean, Ronnie Allen said it was their worst performance of the season. I don't know if that's a fair comment, Dave.
Well, to be fair, there was some competition. I mean, it was just an absolutely abysmal game. They never got going at all. Just never, never stood. And, I think leaving Gary Owen there was a mistake. In hindsight, it's easy to say now, isn't it? But, I mean, Gary Owen was I suppose, in a sense, he could have done what Tony Curry did for Queen's Park Rangers. I mean, he was able to get on the ball and he was a great passer of the ball, Gary Owen, and he could have, maybe dictated things a little bit more for Owen. I mean, he was, I don't know if he still did, but he held the record, didn't he, for the most England under 23 caps without playing a full international. And I mean, he was unlucky that he was in an era when there were a lot of competition in the England midfield. But he was a terrific player, Gary Owen, very underrated, I always thought. And he was the one bit of, I mean, Derek Statham and Cyril, obviously, from that previous team. But Owen was the one bit of class that we'd added in that, in that intervening period. And I remember when we heard the team, we couldn't quite work out what was going on, why he missed out. And he came on fairly early in the second half, if I remember rightly. But it was too late by then because, just the nature of the game, the die had been cast really at that point. I mean, one of the things that we probably never had time to cover in the 70s and the 80s series is how many teams were affected in that period by having to build new stands. Because, Villa, I think, in the early 70s had trouble with that. Albion and Wolves, it cost them dear. Ipswich, I think, were another. Where in that period, where if you wanted to build a new stand, you had to pay for it yourself. And then, of course, in the early 80s, when Thatcher got in and the interest rates went through the roof, all of a sudden the stand that was going to cost you one amount of money suddenly cost you a hell of a lot more. And, we always caught at West Brom, the Halfords Lane, we always call that the Brian Robson stand because we had to sell him to pay for it. That's your problem. I can't speak highly enough of just how great a player Brian Robson was at the Albion. I mean, he was. I think there's every chance that Brian Robson's the greatest player the Albion have ever had, or certainly that they've ever produced. Yeah, there have been great players down the years, but Brian Robson. I always remember that sort of period going and watching that team 78-79. And you'd have got Cyril in there and Laurie Cunningham was in there, Willie Johnston was in there, sometimes Tony Brown was still there. And every week, Brian Robson was the best player. Every week, wherever he played centre-forward, he played midfield, he played left-back, he played centre-half, and he was always the best player. And a team like the Albion can't afford to lose somebody like that. In the same way, in the 70s after Sunderland won the Cup, you can't afford to lose Dennis Stewart, can you? Albion couldn't afford to lose Brian Robson. However much money they got, they couldn't afford to lose him. And of course, he was always going to go because he outgrew what the football club was at that point. But that was the nail in the coffin that Albion never really recovered from, to be perfectly honest.
I mean, Bill, conversely, QPR are on an upward trajectory, certainly beyond this. I think going into the game, they're in ninth position in the second division. They would finish higher. Wembley would give them a spring in the step as much as defeat kind of dragged West Brom, down into a relegation battle that they didn't really need to be involved in. West Brom were lower first division, the lower half first division. But at this point in time, when this result happened, they didn't look like they were going to be involved in a relegation battle at all. But QPR, they'd soon be in the first division. They would qualify for the UEFA Cup. Terry Venables would be, as mad as it sounds in contemporary terms, cherry pick for the Barcelona job. A League Cup final in 86, 80, early doors, 87, 88, they were sat at the top of the first division, went to Anfield as league leaders on the day that John Barnes absolutely tore them apart. The trajectory that QPR went on was pretty metronomic as well.
I mean, the short-term impact, as I say, West Brom lost 9 out of their next 10 games. So whether that was psychological as a result of the semi-final defeat, whether it was tiredness because of two cup runs, who knows? But they really, really did blow up. Conversely, Queen's Park Rangers won 5 out of the next 7. And who knows, had they not got the fixture backlog, they might have got enough points to get up that season. But it probably was a good thing they didn't, because they walked away with the first division the following season. And as you say, Steve, very, very quickly up to fifth place. I mean, it's hard to imagine the very first Premier League, Queen's Park Rangers were fifth. They were in, you ran through their successes, European football, runners up in the league. A lot of that's got to be down to Terry Venables. And when Venables left for Barcelona, the team did kind of split up a bit. But they still kept on being a very, very decent top league side. They had the classic pitch, of course, which may or may not have been an advantage, but they didn't have that for too long anyway. I mean, certainly, Dave, you mentioned building new stands and things like that. I thought the Highbury pitch was relatively poor. I mean, I know we've seen worse ones in the 80s, but it wasn't in the best of condition. And the other depressing thing to add to the match was the crowd. In the 1980s, we weren't even selling out. I'm sure West Brom sold out, but they weren't selling out semi-finals, and QPR didn't have that far to travel. So it was a bit of a depressing time, really.
I think from the Albion's perspective, and that covers all the teams in this area in the Midlands. We were, apart from Villa, who had that good spell at that stage, but we were all struggling to get people in. Just because when Thatcher got in 79, she basically closed the Midlands down within about 12 months. All all of the steel works and all of that just went, and it was pretty grim economic times around here, and we were getting. And I mean, in this season, I think we were getting 13, 14,000 for most, for ordinary first division games. Obviously, you'd still get 20,000 for Liverpool and Villa and Manchester United or whatever. But we were getting, smallish crowds. I don't think we sold, I think we sold 19, 20,000. But I seem to remember sending some of the tickets back for this one. It was, people were skint, basically. I mean, that was how it was. And this area, you saw Albion, Wolves, and Blues all have really tough times for probably 8, 10, 12 years after this, just off the back of that recession. Villa were slightly did slightly better, but even the Villa went into the second division, didn't they, at one point. But yeah, I mean, I think, and football was going through that period in the 80s where just for that little bit, it was a bit of a pariah, wasn't it? Football just generally. As listeners to the 80s series will have already divined. But no, it was a tough sell tickets in this area for that period.
I mean, what was interesting, what very interesting, was that it was West Brom's 19th appearance in the semis. And at that stage, that was a record, I think, for the entire Football League. And how many finals did you get to out of those 19?
10 final, which I think again was still the record at that point. Level, I think, with Everton. Possibly at that stage, it was still record. We've now managed 20 semi-finals. Tells you something about the intervening 40 odd years, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, the 19th FA Cup semi-final for West Brom, QPR's first. I think it was Bill that intimated earlier on that, I don't know, in a no-fear situation, really, for QPR. They did tip up on this game. They lose, no one thinks anything of it. They tip up and win, and they take the headlines and a place at Wembley. Going towards that plastic pitch as well, Dave, up until that run to the semi-finals and obviously onto the final itself, they've won in the third round at Middlesbrough 3-2, and then they've dispensed with Blackpool, Grimsby Town and Crystal Palace on the plastic back at Loftus Road to the tunes of 5-1, 3-1 and 1-0. There were vague rumblings from QPR of earlier in the cup run of them pulling out of the competition because of the complaints about the plastic pitch and the advantage they were getting for it. This was a peculiar time in this respect, shall we say.
If only, if only. Although then we probably lost to Grimsby in the semi-final instead. So maybe it's hard now to remember just what a big controversy the plastic pitch was back in the early 80s. But I mean, it did seem to be the, you know, to everybody else it seemed unfair, didn't it? You know, and I suppose particularly in the cup competition, everybody was kind of up in arms about it, because if you are drawn it out in the league, it feels less important, because if okay, you get a QPR and lose, well, you know, you've still got another 40 odd games and your season's not judged on that. But in the FA Cup, if you end up going to Loftus Road and it's on a plastic pitch, you feel hard done by if you lose that game. And yeah, I think that was probably fair enough. I mean, that whole plastic pitch thing was a very peculiar notion. I mean, because it did, particularly in those days, it did behave so weirdly compared to. I mean, now it's less of a thing. You know, even in Scotland, they still complain about playing on plastic pitches in the Premier League. But I mean, back then, it was just a bizarre thing. And I mean, you know, Albion, they're known for the boing boing thing, which came 10 years later, maybe 9-10 years later, and that supposedly started an away game at Preston on a plastic pitch where the ball was bouncing so hard that the supporters just kept going boing boing, and that was where it came from, so they say. That may be another one of those urban myths, but yeah, I mean I can absolutely understand in the cup competitions people saying, well, this isn't right. You know, that this is giving them too much of an advantage. Home advantage is one thing, but playing on a weird surface as well, I mean, that's a bit too much. Throw them out the cup now. We'll replay the final.
Yeah. Yeah. John Burridge, the goalkeeper, refused to play on it, didn't he? The Queen's Park Rangers goalkeeper at the time. I know he had lots of clubs.
And even then, there were kind of like two different types of plastic pitch. I think the QPR one was known as OmniTurf, where it was basically a carpet rolled onto concrete. And the Luton one was a bit more, I don't know, advanced for its era. And that had kind of like base layers of like, I don't know, sand and rock and all sorts of stuff. It was a multi-layered thing, but it was still the same effect, that mad bounce of the ball. You know, you can point to Oldham Athletic as well, and theirs at Boundary Park. They reached the 1990 League Cup final, same season that they reached the FA Cup semi-final, and, you know, miss out on the playoffs, but they're promoted the following season, you know, again on the plastic. You know, those adventures that they had were heavily, you know, influenced by their flexible friend. You know, Jim Smith at QPR notoriously hated the surface. Intriguingly, that season in which they were top of the first division, 87-88, you know, as approaching autumn, they think they dropped about 20 points at home that season. You know, Jim Smith had no time for it whatsoever. And I think he was the prime driving force in the dispensing of the QPR plastic pitch. But yeah, clearly, you know, I think the proof in the pudding here is maybe the Crystal Palace game in the quarterfinal. That's maybe the one you'd expect them to beat Blackpool. You'd expect them maybe to beat Grimsby, although that's a decent Grimsby side around about that era that knock on the door of the first division. On the opposite side of the spectrum, West Brom's run up to this point has taken in Blackburn at home, 3-2 victory, on the road at Gillingham 1-0. Norwich City in the fifth round 1-0, and Coventry City in the quarterfinals 2-0. Three clean sheets in succession there. I can fully understand why the West Brom players, or certainly some of them, were mulling the concept of a replay and where the venue might be, Dave.
It was a game that never thought there was going to be a goal in it. I mean, it was just such a sterile non-event of a football match all the way through. QPR contained Albion and had the best of the football, to be perfectly honest, and Albion didn't get going. But, you know, it was, I mean, you know, we were saying the same sort of thing on the terraces at that point. It just looked like it was inevitably going to be, I think it would have been the Wednesday night, the replay, and then, you know, you're already starting to think, right, well, we're going to have to get to the Hawthorns tomorrow morning at like 8 o'clock to start queuing for the tickets to get to Villa Park. You know, you're starting to think of all that because it just looks nil-nil all over it. Unfortunately, it wasn't. But I mean, it was a funny cup run from Albion's perspective, because that one in 78 was just a fantastic run. The games were brilliant. You know, they beat Manchester United in a replay. The replay was a fantastic game at the Hawthorns on an absolute muddy. Then they won at Derby. They beat Nottingham Forest, who were, you know, unbeaten forever at that stage. So that was a great cup. But this was kind of a bloodless thing. The Blackburn game wasn't a bad game. Gillingham away, I mean, I think Gillingham were third, probably fourth division at that point, and they squeaked through 1-0. The fifth round, the Norwich game at home, again, was nothing much. But he had that goal from Cyril Regis where he chests the ball down in the centre circle, turns, runs 20 yards, and then absolutely smears it into the top corner at the goal at the Smethy King, one goal of the season. And then we played Coventry, and in that era, however bad we were always going to beat Coventry. It was just automatic. We were always beat Coventry. So there was no problem with that. And then this game was just a non-event, and that was the biggest disappointment, I think. I mean, you know, when you've lost, you want something to cling to, don't you? You know, and in 78 we'd had John Wyle cracking his head open after about 5 minutes when even Brian Talbot went up for that, and, you know, blood caked on his shirt and all that sort. So you can feel that the world's against you on occasions like that. Oh, bloody hell. Yeah. But this game, we just didn't deserve to win. We deserve to get beat. And of all teams, it was against QPR, who, of course, had beaten us in 1967 in the first ever League Cup final at Wembley after we were 2-0 up and they were in the third division. We contrived to lose 3-2 in the second half. So QPR's never been one of our favourite teams, really.
So, at least for the Butcher, that was a great game.
I can't believe that you choose this game and then say it wasn't even a giant killing. Dear mate. We just have to find some Sunderland games next season.
Well, you know, just to be fair to West Brom, the final was just as bad as the semi-final.
It was terrible, wasn't it?
That was 0-0 after 90 minutes as well. So it's a down to Venables and his tactics. And the replay wasn't much better.
No. I mean, he did a job. You know, he suffocated the game, really. He didn't let Albion, you know, he didn't let Derek Statham get forward, which was, you know, I mean, Derek Statham was a fabulous player. And I still think Kenny Sansom stole 70 of his England caps off him, frankly, but that's another story. And he didn't let him get forward. He didn't let Brendan Batson get forward on the other side. And that was a big outlet for Albion. It kept those two sort of pinned back. And there was no, with Gary Owen not playing, there was nobody in the midfield to sort of open things up. So I mean, he got his tactics right. You know, I think he did the same in the final against Spurs. It didn't make for particularly attractive watching, but you know, in the semi final at least, he did the job, and very nearly in the final as well.
Yeah, again, fine margins there. Yeah, the QPR, although they don't within this getting through to the final. They just don't have the chance. Like West Ham won it, and Southampton won it, and Sunderland won it as a second division side. But it's almost like they just don't quite have the charm of, say, kind of like Brighton the following year in reaching the FA Cup final and being relegated in the same season. I think it just lacks that classic final to make this QPR side. And the fact that, you know, they came so close to winning the league title in 75-76 as well. It's mad to think that as a second division side reaching the FA Cup final seems such a secondary story to so much else that QPR managed to do for themselves, you know, within a 15-year radius of that FA Cup final.
That 75-76 team, it's full of... It's got Stan Bowles in it for a starter, you know. It's got Dave Thomas in it. It's got all that personality and that excitement. And, you know, I'm taking nothing away from this, the team that beat Albion, because, you know, they deserve to go through. But it hadn't got that same glamour to it. It hadn't quite got that same personality. It was more functional than that team was. It hadn't got the ability to get the pulses racing the same way that the 75-76 team did. That's no criticism of them. They did the job that they needed to do on the day, but it wasn't, you're right, it doesn't sort of capture the imagination in the same way that, you know, those other ones. And even that team that beat Albion in 67, you know, it's Rodney Marsh, he's in that team. There's that glamour and that bit of glitz to it, isn't there? Where there's none of that. And, you know, you think back to to West Ham, winning it 2 years early from the second division, you know, and they've got Trevor Brooking in that team, and you know, go back to Southampton in 76, and it's Mick Shannon and Peter Osgood are in that team. You know, the Sunderland, well, there's the miraculous side from Jim Montgomery, and then there's, you know, great players like Dennis Stewart in that side, and there's the goal from they've all got something extra to them, and that this QPR is more workmanlike than any of that, I think, and that's probably why this one slips under the radar a little bit, because it hasn't got that glamorous edge to it.
I mean, even their big flair player Tony Curry, Venables played him really deep, didn't he? He didn't even free rein to spray the ball around. He played very, very deep. And I've always liked Simon Stainrod. I thought he was a real quality player. But as you said, Dave, they put on a workmanlike display. They were disciplined. They no doubt did exactly what Venables told them to do. And it might have been boring, but on the day it worked, and it's worth doing, isn't it, if you get a place at Wembley?
I mean, Dave, Terry Venables, is pragmatism in this as well. We spoke a little bit in the 70s series, and when we come to look at his rise in Crystal Palace side that went from third to first division, now just how frugal they were in terms of, you know, goals conceded, but also goals scored. You know, I think people associate a bit of flair, certainly to that Crystal Palace side. That's the, you know, maybe it's that kit that absorbs so much light and attention that makes you, I don't know, not quite notice that the football wasn't quite as free flowing as it might have we might have thought it was at the time.
People do sort of think of Terry Venables as being an exciting sort of man. Yeah, you know, I'm jaundiced by this terrible thing that happened to me when I was 18. Got this cup of semi-final, but I mean, that was never to me the way that Terry Venables played the game. He was always based on a very good, solid defence that wasn't going to give many goals away. Now, you know, that's what coaches do, isn't it? You know, if you don't give many goals away, you're always going to give yourself a chance. And as they did in this game, I mean, it's a terrible goal that comes about by accident, really. I mean, fair play to Clive Allen for pressing forward into the box to try and make something happen, but he basically gets by a clearance in the back of the net. And that's what happens. But Terry Venables was... He got them organised. He wasn't going to concede goals. And that was the bottom line. And if it went to a replay at 0-0, it went to a replay at 0-0. And he wasn't particularly bothered by that. He was quite happy to try and win it at the second attempt. That just didn't make for a particularly attractive game. But it made for, you know, it got the job done. But I do find that, you know, the way that people talk about Terry Venables, he's one of those people that passes me by. I don't quite get what all the acclaim is for Terry Venables. I never have. And, you know, what did he win in the end? You know, with people put him in that bracket of the great coaches and stuff. I don't want to speak ill of him, but, you know, I just think he was a very, very good coach. I don't think he's necessarily elevated to a great coach, because in the finish, he didn't win the things that Bob Paisley won. He didn't win the things that Brian Clough won. And in the end, I suppose that's the acid test of a great coach, isn't it?
It is indeed. West Brom, you know, beyond this 1981-82 season and this double flirtation with Wembley, because they lose out on a place in the League Cup final by a goal, you know, over 2 legs, you know, lose this semi-final against QPR when it's theirs to win, and then, you know, the following season. Now, an 11th place finish isn't, you know, too bad, but then 17th in 83-84, you know, back up towards mid-table, and 12th in 84-85, but then, you know, it's through the floor in 85-86, not to return for, what was it, 16 years into that wilderness. Just what difference do you think an FA Cup final in 1982 for West Bromwich Albion would have made to those years that followed, compared to what unfolded on the back of the reality of losing the semi-final?
It is an interesting question. I mean, whether they would have beaten Tottenham in the cup final is another story. But for the purposes of the, let's assume that they did. I mean, it makes them a more attractive team, obviously, for players to come to. Whereas as it was, there they were, stuck at the bottom of the division, the first division, only just about survived. And you know, I'm just looking at the transfers in that they had the following summer: Peter Easter and Paul Barron. Now, again, no disrespect to them, decent first division players, but it's not going to get you excited, is it? Peter Easter, who by that stage was coming towards the end of his career, I suppose. He would have been late 20s, early 30s. At that stage, Paul Barron, you know, routine goalkeeper. It's not getting anybody excited. As I say, fundamentally the problem was that they'd still got to pay for this stand that they'd built, which was suddenly a lot more expensive than they thought it was going to be. And that caused a lot of problems in the same way that it did for Ipswich when they had to sell off all the best players. You sell off your best players, you're in trouble.
You'd already done that, haven't you? You know, you got rid of Robson and Moses. You look at the West Brom team in the semi, and there are not many assets there, are there? You know, most of them are past their best.
Yeah, I mean, and the better players that they've got. I mean, John Wall, I think, finished that year. Derek Stadham started to get one or two injuries. Cyril got one or two injuries. They never quite went on to reach what they probably could have reached. And it needed a proper rebuild. And again, with all due respect, a proper rebuild isn't Peter Easto and Paul Barron. You know, it needed to bring in some bigger players. But, to be honest, the Albion story is the same story for lots and lots of those teams that did well in the 70s and then couldn't carry it on in the 80s, partly financial mismanagement. And also the fact that football was changing, freedom of contract, made a big difference. So it was easy for your big players to move on. And fair play to them. It's a short career. Why wouldn't you move on? But that doesn't make it easy. It's much harder for a team of the size of an Albion or of an Ipswich or a Wolves or whatever from the 80s onwards to build a team and to keep a team than it had been 20 years earlier in the 60s and the early 70s. And I think ultimately that would always have caught up with Albion. I mean, you know, it might not have been quite so traumatic and collapsed so badly. And to be fair to the club, they did try when John Giles came back 18 months later. You know, they brought in a few players. They brought in the likes of Imre Varadi and Garth Crooks to try and revitalise things. It just didn't work. And then we embarked on the great sadness for 16 years. That was, it seemed like about 60. But, I think, you know, for clubs of that size and, you know, Sunderland, bigger club than the Albion, Newcastle, bigger club than the Albion, they've had their own problems in that period as well, just because it became very, very difficult to compete. I think it certainly would have slowed it down, because if you win the cup, that probably gets you 2 or 3 years grace. But I think ultimately it probably would have caught up with them at some stage. And you know, the terrible truth is, as a football club, I mean, this is the end of Albion as a significant football club, in the sense of a team that's going to win anything. You know, I mean, your football club, whichever your club is, you know, it can be Albion, it can be Walsall, it can be Halifax, it can be whoever it is. Your football club matters to you for all sorts of things. It's a community and your family and all that stuff. It doesn't change how important your football club is to you and to your supporters. But this was the point at which Albion stopped being a team that could challenge for anything. And those days, well, unless this new fella who's bought him goes absolutely mental, those days have gone probably, you know, forever. I mean, and you know, you even look at Leicester City won the league, and then within 2 or 3 years, most of their best players have been picked off, because that's the nature of how modern football is. The bigger clubs will always take them away from you. And you know, as you've talked about, Stephen, and with all the other guys in the 80s series, that's where football is changing. The real fault line of where football goes from being, you know, the 1960s and the 1970s, where you've got loads and loads of teams winning the league, loads and loads of teams winning the cup. The 80s is when it starts to solidify into, well, there's about four teams that can win that, and that's it. And Albion would always have been the victims of that, I think.
And I've always found this particular semi-final fascinating in terms of, like we said before we were gone.
Yeah, you didn't have to watch it.
But it's those divergences afterwards rather than the 90 minutes of football itself that bring so much to this one. Bill, Sunderland, 1981-82, the FA Cup. Any recollections of how far they got and where they might have gone out?
Yeah, I mean, I was out of love with football at the time, but I think we drew away with Rotherham, who were probably in the third division then, beat them at home in a much delayed replay. And a few days later, we played some team from Merseyside. Was it Liverpool? And they hammered us 3-0.
It was indeed Liverpool, but then we contrived to go out in the very next round away at Chelsea, the second time we had lost at Stamford Bridge in 4 years in the FA Cup. And this time it was even more abysmal, the fact that they were languishing in the second division. The point in time when they were flirting, I think, within a projected flirtation with the third division at by to the tail end of that season or the one afterwards. But yes, Sunderland out in the fourth round, Liverpool out in the fifth round. Yeah, so you've nothing to be ashamed of this season. You left us in the shade this season.
Just to finish with the point that Bill made about the crowd being a lot, quite small. I think 40,000. I do remember that the one 4 years earlier, and it was absolutely rammed. As we came away from the ground to go back to the coaches or whatever, I vividly remember. I was 14. There must have been 20 or 30 yards up the road away from Ivy where my feet didn't touch the ground. And you just think, oh well. At the time, you don't think anything about it, but that thing that Nick Hornby says about Hillsborough in fever pitch, when Hillsborough happened, I had a flashback to that, because you think, that could have been us at any, and you think then of how badly we were all treated as football supporters over that period, and now you can argue that it never occurred to people that it could happen, but they didn't care that it could happen to us, did they, really, in the end? And
It was.
that could easily have been, and it wasn't even in the ground, it was coming away from the ground, the way that they're treating it.
Pre-85, we had that at York, and obviously York's a tiny ground, so it'll bring a lot of fans. And the police, believe it or not, opened the gates to allow the fans in. The Hillsborough sort of scenario. Sunderland supporters naturally climbed over the fence, ran onto the pitch. We got fined. It's just crazy, crazy times.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think around about that period of time, I think it was 84, League Cup semi-final at Walsall, and the wall going down, behind the goal and stuff like that. Souness picking a kid up, who was injured, and carrying safety and stuff like that. Absolutely treated awfully as a football supporter at that point in time, without a shadow of a doubt. Bill, fantastic as always. Absolutely enjoyed this. Have you got a final in mind yet?
Well, I mean, we've done Sunderland and Leeds to death, but I will never tire of talking about Sunderland and Leeds. I don't think Wimbledon Liverpool was giant killing. I don't know what you guys think. There wasn't that far distance between the two clubs. We thought about Wigan and Manchester City, but was the FA Cup really as important as it used to be when Wigan won it? So I think there's a bit of thinking to be done. But I'm more worried about Dave. I mean, bringing back all these memories, I think you'll need some therapy. Just look at the league table today and see where Albion are. I reckon you're headed for the playoffs, and you'll be back.
Well, we shall see. No, I mean, it's been interesting to think it back. I mean, you're right, Stephen. It is one of those sort of turning point games, really. As I say, I don't think it would ultimately. I don't think things would have been much different, but certainly for the next 3 or 4 years, it made a difference. And as Bill says, I could easily have gone down that year off the back of the semi-final, really. So, it's interesting to go back to that.
Wonderful as always. And Dave, has it been to not too painful for you? I think we christened this, I think we decided to call this the Paul McParlan program of football nightmare therapies. How has your hour on the couch been?
It's been an education. The only thing I can say is after 1978 and 1982, they didn't knock our hybrid down quick enough.
You can never lose an FA Cup semi-final there again. That's
Exactly.
a bright way to finish it on. Wonderful as always. All that leaves you to do is say thank you for listening. Please do join us again next time when we'll be looking at the final itself and one of the giant killings of its time. This has been another podcast from These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.